Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Anne Day. Day is a poet and artist. A British citizen, she was among the evacuees of British children to the U.S. during the beginning of World War II. She is the author of a beautiful collection of poetry about her wartime experiences called We Have Saved What We Can, Poems of War and Refuge. It was published by Cuga Lake Books. Day is also an award-winning watercolorist. And welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, your poetry collection, We Have Saved What We Can, is a kind of a poetry diary about your life, especially during World War II and the immediate repercussions that happened afterwards. Can you tell us a little bit about your childhood and this huge event that happened?
Well, I was in Jersey, Channel Islands. My father was in the British Navy, and our house was near the Navy base, and everybody thought that would be bombed first. So we went to my grandparents in Jersey, where we went every summer anyway, but This time we stayed, supposedly for the length of the war. But Jersey, you know, can be seen from France and vice versa. And pretty soon it was obvious that France was not having a good time of it.
Oh, yeah.
And finally we got this phone call, and my father said, "You have an hour. Get out. They're coming."
That's the message that you got. Oh, my gosh.
One hour.
It was you and your three siblings and your mother, and then you brought your grandmother. To tell us a little bit more. Your father was in the armed
services.
My
father was a captain in the British Navy. My mother had never taken care of us. She was a pilot and did a lot of other things. And we would go in the summers to be with her family in Jersey. We had a nanny, of course, which meant that when we finally were refugees and got on this boat, and my mother was the only one allowed to go with us, She didn't have a clue. You know, here was my baby brother needing to have his diaper changed, and she didn't know how such things were done.
That's unbelievable.
So I had to show her. And when we got to America, we discovered that we had a very small house, which was given to us. Lovely little house, Duxbury, Massachusetts. Tiny little kitchen. I don't think my mother had ever stepped into a kitchen before.
Wow.
And she looked at me and said, "We're going to have to learn to cook." And we did.
So you had to grow up really fast, sounds like.
And yes, because the others were
How old were you at this time?
I was 13.
So you had to really become almost your mother's parent.
Yes, in a sense, yes, because I knew more about, especially the children, you know, because I'd grown up as the eldest. And so, yes, I knew something about the children. But we learned. We learned to cook. We learned to be on our own in a house. And
yeah. Well, what was it like on that ship across? Was it just total anxiety?
The ship from Jersey to England, the one ahead of us, was torpedoed and sunk. We were just lucky. You know, they didn't happen to find us. The ship coming from England to America after this great uncle had invited us to join a ship of 400 children that he was bringing to New York was a different matter altogether. We were just, again, lucky. The ship, we were too many students or too many kids, and the other group that they were taking were German prisoners of war.
Oh, my.
So they shoveled around. They put us in the prisoner of war ship because it was larger. They put the prisoners of war into the children's ship. So the Germans knew that these were the first British refugees, and they wanted to stop that business immediately so that people's parents would not be content thinking their children were safe.
Wow.
So they torpedoed us. Supposedly, but of course they torpedoed their own German prisoners of war because we had shifted ships.
Oh, how, what an interesting twist of fate. Wow.
Just absolute luck.
Yeah.
And
oh,
we, all
gosh.
These people swimming in the water and out in the middle of the Atlantic.
It must have been horrifying.
It was horrifying.
In so many ways.
It was horrifying.
Well, Anne, I want you to read from your collection a poem called No Warning. And then this will tell our listeners a little something about how you felt.
All right. There are no farewells, no kisses on cheeks, no hands raised as the ship pulls away, no shouts of advice, no tears, no warnings. War hurries us into whatever is moving. We whisper and huddle together. We hold the one bag permitted, a pen in our pockets, and follow the crowd. Every ship is immense, a black hull above us. The gangplank is crowded with others. At the end of a dock, dark water beckons. Silence and shiftings are all I remember. One scream, yes, but a boy beyond reason. The rest of us move as a herd. Were the others seeing green lawns left behind? Hearing the hiss of a hose, the complaint of a gate, waves on the sand? Behind us, the doors of the dockyard swing shut. Quiet men cast off the ropes. A shudder of engines and three ships without lights move out into the limitless ocean.
Wow, that's an amazing poem. Was it hard for you to start thinking about all of these experiences and to start writing about it? It's almost autobiographical, obviously.
It is, and I didn't start until I was in my 40s. And then, for some reason or other, it was just something I wanted to do. I wanted to get it down. As much as anything else, I thought it would be good for my children to know what they were doing with a half and half American, half English mother.
Yeah.
And so that's where I began.
Yeah. Did you ever think that you would rather write a memoir? Was it always going to be poetry?
I don't know why it was poetry when I think back on it. But that's what I started doing. Uh-huh. And then I sent out a few things and they got published. And so that encouraged me to keep on with it.
Uh-huh. And did you know that this whole book was going to be about this experience? I mean, it sounds like
poems
were flowing out of you in regard to these experiences.
No, I was just these three young men who were doing the publication asked to see what I had that were like the ones I had read at a reading. And so I put together the bunch that seemed to be what they wanted to hear.
Yeah, it's a fascinating collection. It really is. Now, let's continue with the story. I mean, if the trauma of having to exit from your country wasn't bad enough, your father got killed during the last day of the war.
Last day of the war.
To talk to us a little bit about that.
Well, he was captain of an aircraft carrier, and they were in the Pacific by this time. I mean, the war was coming to an end. And in Australia, the naval people called him to come in with a bunch of other admirals and captains of the British fleet that were there to be told that the atom bomb was going to be used with the assumption that that was going to be the end of the war.
Wow.
So they flew in to Australia and they had all this official meeting. They got out. The plane was one from my father's ship, and there was a pilot, obviously. So a couple of admirals and my father and a couple of other captains got back in the plane, and they were never seen again.
And so you never found out what happened?
And it was the day the war ended.
So when did you guys hear about it, though? It must have been, you know, delayed.
That night, as a matter of fact. The British Navy called my mother and told her.
And did she tell you immediately?
Yes.
Wow.
Told me immediately, yes.
Oh, that must have been you must have still had some hope, though, that they might find him.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Because they didn't have, you know, bodies.
Yeah.
They had missing people. And later, just a few years ago, when I was in Australia visiting cousins, I said, I want to go to the naval. I know there's one system that was for Navy people, and I want to go there and find my father's grave. And they said, oh, no, you don't want to do that, blah, blah, blah. And we never did it. And I later found out, of course, they had nothing to bury.
Yeah.
So they had some kind of a service, but there were no bodies.
Yeah. Oh, that's such a sad story.
Yeah.
Well, thankfully, he got his family out. I do want you to read another poem from the collection, Waiting for Another... Well, what's the name?
Crusoe. Yes.
Yep.
Okay. Nobody would say where my father went and the other men with him in the plane. Australia once below and then behind them, and a vast acreage of water stretched endlessly in all directions under them, on which the shadow of their fragile craft shivered, moving into emptiness. It was the last day of the war. Rejoicing must have kept the trained eyes and ears of their companions at the base from following the course they took, from noticing their disappearance off the radar. Did the last dark silhouette of the old enemy appear above them? Was there a cloud that swallowed one more of what the heavens might have thought simply another bird strayed from the flock, heading for summer pastures? For a time, I dreamed the plane landed on an unknown island where my father began a new life, made a new world with different daughters. Pacific being, after all, a word that conjures up calm and palm trees, a green oasis waiting for another Crusoe.
Wow. That's great. Does your family, you can only speak for yourself, I suppose, do you still wait for closure, or do you feel like you got some closure by visiting that
I think finally
port?
We just accepted it. My mother's reaction, which was, of course, the important one, was to stay in America, which nobody had thought we would do, including the uncle who'd brought us across.
Mm.
But we had this house. And I was at Mount Holyoke, and my brother was at Harvard. And she said, this is silly to pack up and go back to England at this point. By the time we had graduated, I married an American, and she married an American.
Wow.
And that really settled it, and we became American, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Did you still feel the ghost of things left undone from the war?
Oh, yes.
Because a lot of these poems sound like you
yes.
do. You do.
Yeah.
Can you think of any way where you would find closure? Would they have to find the bodies of your father?
I think so, yes. It sounds awful to say it, but one thing that makes a difference in that way is that the people left in England were grandparents and so forth, and they died, one of them in the war and one of them just after the war. And that kind of closed down that part of my life.
Yeah.
And the manor house in Jersey that had been our home became a hotel.
Wow.
The family sold it.
Yeah.
And things like that made a difference.
And it helped you sort of realize that that was not
yeah,
going
to... That,
that's
that
the
was
old
a life,
life.
Past.
That's something
you
had
to
leave behind.
Go on with a new one.
Yeah, no. Yeah. Now, you know, a lot of your poems are about feeling foreign in a strange land, not feeling like you belong.
Yeah.
Did it take you a long time to navigate and
try
to become...
You know, there'd be moments when you suddenly realized that other people found you different.
Uh-huh.
And...
In what way, though? Because there was no language barrier, obviously.
There was no language.
In what way?
The accent, I think, was one problem. And I don't know. There was just, even at college, there were a lot of, by that time, you people were in the war, too.
Uh-huh.
And there were other refugees whom I knew at Holyoke. And we had some very good times. We thoroughly enjoyed the college. And most of us remained in America, as it happens. It just takes time
uh-huh.
to make yourself into a different person.
Yeah, and you feel like you did have to make yourself into a different person.
Yes.
Is that true?
I didn't want to be a foreigner with a capital F.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
I felt we were here. Ultimately, I married and had children. Those children were American children. And I felt that I needed to be their American mother.
Uh-huh. And this must have been harder for your mother, though. Obviously, kids can adapt a lot easier than adults.
It was harder for her. But on the other hand, she then married an American. And I think that helped her, too.
Yeah.
But suddenly we felt as if this is where we all lived, you know.
Uh-huh. Did you feel during some of this time that you did want to keep some of the rituals and some of the memories in regard to your own culture
and pass
it on to your kids?
Oh, yes.
And can you give us an example of any of those rituals or like drinking tea, perhaps,
well,
the stereotype?
Well, I was going to say, we used to have tea time in my mother's lifetime, and we still continue to do that. But once I got to be the person who was working so that my then husband could finish college at Dartmouth and then go on and get an MA and a PhD. So I was working all day long, and they were my children were at that point in school.
Mm.
So tea had to be given up, obviously. And a few other things like that. had to be given up. For instance, my mother had always been the one in our family who did the driving, other than the chauffeur.
Ah.
But she did the driving. And my father wasn't there, so it was natural that she would do it. When we got to America, she did not want to ask for a car. So she stopped driving, and she never drove again to the end of her life.
Wow.
We did an awful lot of walking.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ann Day. We're talking about her collection of poetry about her World War II experience. It's called We Have Saved What We Can, Poems of War and Refuge. And Ann, I want to get you to read another poem from the collection. This one's called Strangers, which is what we were talking about, you trying to adapt to a new country.
Strangers. Here is the new land and all that was promised. The Statue of Liberty holding up her lamp, the tall buildings and the endless rushing past of people speaking with strange accents. How quickly we forgot the dark sea passage on the submarine. How easy to adopt these new, simpler ways. The hubbub of the crowded streets, bright lights, the tomato soup and graham crackers our new uncle thought appropriate for our youthful palates. How we shocked him on the drive to his house as we pulled at his car's door handles and made explosive mouth sounds as we bombed each bridge we crossed, saving our family from the German spies who had tracked our escape and would wait for us, even on this seemingly calm, tree-lined American parkway. Howard Johnson's was the next stop. Chocolate shakes and triple-decker sandwiches topped with plastic flags in many colors. Perhaps this was heaven. It was some weeks before we asked ourselves why we were safe. Surely there must be a debt to pay for oranges, for waking in the night to press our noses to the screen of a bedroom window and smell the new grass growing instead of filing downstairs to shelter from the inevitable bombings. And there was a payment due. From now on, no matter where we lived, we would be strangers.
Wow, that's wonderful. Did you find it cathartic writing some of these poems? Was it a cleansing for you in many ways?
I think it was. It put me back in some of those early times, you know, and I could write about them and try to, in a sense, tell myself what it was about that time that A, I remembered, and B, I wanted to remember.
Yeah.
You know, it was a whole different world.
Yeah.
Lots of servants, lots of gardeners in the garden, a whole different life.
Do you feel like it was a really sheltered life in many ways? I mean,
I never thought of it that way. It was just the way it was.
Uh-huh.
You know, it was a very large manor house of my grandparents where we were living in the last couple of years of our life. And a lot of servants and the butler who occasionally allowed us to polish the silver and so on. And then all of a sudden, here we are. We have our own little house. And we've got to learn, both my mother and I, we have to learn how to cook. We have to learn how to care for ourselves.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, that's always a good thing.
Yeah.
I don't think we felt gypped. We felt that we were being given an opportunity to be, quote, real people, unquote.
Yeah, yeah. And also an opportunity for a second life, considering
absolutely.
What you saw was
absolutely.
Happening around you.
Yes.
Unbelievable story.
Yeah.
Now, how did you keep your accent? You still have an accent.
That's depressing to hear. I always think I don't have one.
No, absolutely. You still have an accent, and I didn't expect you to.
Well, there are moments, I think, when I don't, probably. When I'm talking to somebody like you who doesn't know me, I suppose it comes back a bit more clearly or something.
Perhaps that's because you're talking about the past, too, I was thinking.
That could be.
Yeah.
That could be.
Tell us how you wrote your poems. Did you feel snippets coming at you and you'd have to rush and write down lines? Or did you actually put yourself in quiet rooms deliberately trying to remember? And
I do. I write poems early in the morning.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And in the days when I was working, of course, it had to also be at night because it had to be sometime when I was free to do so. And yes, there'd usually be an activity, a vision, a memory. And so you begin.
Uh-huh.
And then it just makes itself, you know. And then afterwards, of course, you start correcting and so forth and so on. But the idea comes with the memory.
Yeah. And, you know, I noticed most of these poems, they're tough, a lot of them, and a lot of them are very beautiful. Did you find yourself ever censoring yourself and not wanting to talk publicly, so to speak, about some of your experiences?
No.
Really?
I never thought of them as, I guess I never thought of them as being very different. After all, my childhood, the parts I remember most clearly are all about war.
Yeah.
And survival. And in a sense, even though that's been years and years and years and years ago, I felt that I was moving back into my childhood and actually looking at it. How did it work, you know?
It's a remarkable collection. I want you to read another from it. It's called We Have Saved What We Can, the title poem.
Okay. Having only my arms, I hold the dog to my chest, his heart beating against mine, and put one book, a pencil, a scrap of paper, and a few smooth beach stones into my pocket. Because I've been told I must, I've hung my gas mask over my shoulder. Everything else must be stored in the fragile basket of the mind, the glint of the dinner gong in the depths of the hall, the black carpeted staircase rising in silence past the glitter of red, blue, green lights from a stained glass window on the landing, one twilight with a single line of cows following each other to the barn for milking, and the faint hush and slap of the tide rising and falling beyond the window, slices of bread held to the gas fire for toasting. 7 decades later, I spread these treasures before you, all that is left of that life. Keep it safe. Even the stones are important.
I love that one. I absolutely love that one. Now, let's talk a little bit about this other thread that has run through your life, and that is watercolors.
Oh.
You're a watercolorist, and you're a wonderful watercolorist.
I love doing it.
When did you start doing that?
That I started quite a bit earlier, actually. I was probably still, maybe in my late teens, and I started painting. Unfortunately, I never had any lessons. Never had any opportunity to do that. And when I got to college, I majored in other things and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But the wish to put down what impressed me here and there continued. And so I continued to paint. And now I've given classes in watercolor. And I always tell people, this is absurd. I never had any myself. So you have to take it from my, you know, from what I do, not from what I know.
You know, that's exactly how people learn art.
I mean,
by doing it. So,
I think.
So I'm not sure if classes might have destroyed your technique.
Maybe.
They might have told you you're doing it wrong, and it's beautiful stuff.
Well, I love doing it. It's great fun.
I recommend that people get Anne's book, too. Get a copy of it, because one of her watercolors is the cover. It's beautiful. It's really beautiful stuff. Now, were you painting from, you know, sitting in the landscape or from photographs? I doubt that you were using photographs way back then, right?
No, sitting in the landscape.
You were actually sitting in the landscape.
Yes, and still do now.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes the weather defeats you a bit, and you have to do a quick sketch and then finish it at home. And to that extent, some of it's made up because the other thing's not in front of you. But if I can, I'm always sitting there,
sitting
doing it in the scene, yes.
Were you ever interested in watercolors of people and trying to remember people from your life?
I've got some people in them, but that's one thing, not one place where it seems to me that to have done it professionally and been taught, I could really use some help with that. People are very difficult. Occasionally,
I get...
Somebody in a painting who just happens to be there and is far enough away so I can kind of invent him, he or she. But most often, it's a landscape.
Yeah, and it looks like the cover of your book is a painting from your past.
Yes,
from
it's my grandfather and grandmother's manor house in Jersey.
So are you doing watercolors the way you are poetry, watercolors of memory as well?
No. No, for the most part, I'm doing where I am now.
Ah, okay.
Yes. This I did years ago, and it's a much bigger picture than this one on the cover.
Uh-huh.
But I did do it from a photograph and also from having been home at one point and doing a sketch and put them together.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, since your collection is all about memory and some of your experiences, do you think it's important for us to continue to remember World War II? I mean, a lot of people are dying, obviously, who actually were there.
Yeah.
My father's one of them. He's 95 years old and still around. But how important do you think it is to keep that memory alive of what happened?
I think for me it's important. It explains to me why I am where I am and who I am.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that I think people who weren't in it should fuss about it. We've got our own lives to live now, and as you know, we've got other problems with armies going forth.
But what about that old adage about learning from history? If you don't remember history, you can't learn lessons from it.
Well, I think it's a good idea, but those of us who were actually there sometimes have rather difficult memories.
Mm-hmm.
And I found my brother who went to the Korean War, because if you serve in the army, you know, you become a citizen automatically.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So he was at Harvard, and they said to him, you either go home or you
fight. You serve in Korea. Oh,
and
my gosh.
Korea. And he did. And he, as it turned out, once he returned, he did his major at Harvard in the language of Korea, which they thought was crazy, but a number of other boys came back wanting the same thing.
Yeah.
And he then lived the rest of his life in Korea and married a Korean wife.
Wow.
But, I mean, people who want to study history, that's fine. And if they want to know how it actually was in the bombings and stuff, well, there are lots of people like me who can tell you.
Mm.
But I would be just as glad that my children never had to have that experience.
Yeah, I can understand that.
Yeah.
Now we only have a couple minutes left. Are you continuing to write? Are you writing about now?
Oh, I'm writing about now. Now.
Uh-huh. And so you're writing about your current life.
And yes, and you know, we've only just moved. We've been here about 5 years, but we've retired to this area because my present husband was at Cornell and wanted to come here. And we've made a lot of friends. And so I'm writing about that. And I'm writing about other phases of life as they come to me. And but they're all, you know, they're not back in this area like these poems are.
What kind of advice would you give somebody who's never written and is afraid to begin?
Oh, sit down and start making lines. Now, you may not want to do poems. You may want to end up doing short stories or something. But whatever it is, whether it's a memory or whether it is something you're imagining completely, sit down and get at it. And the minute you do it, you'll begin to see the mistakes and also the good parts.
That's great.
And it's great fun.
That's great. Are you going to be giving any readings in the next couple months?
I think so, yes. Uh-huh.
So people look out
I think
notices.
Perhaps at the library in Drummondsburg and perhaps at the bookstore.
That's great.
And I know in some other towns where friends have said they want to have me do it.
Well, great. Well, Ann Day, this has been an absolute delight talking to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for asking me.
And again, the book is called We Have Saved What We Can, Poems of War and Refuge. Ann Day, thank you so much. Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.